Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're following up our, this is episode 204, and in episode 202, we talked about Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis, and now it's time for part two, Perelandra, which is the name of Venus.
Yes.
Yes.
Ransom is on the go again.
He is. This guy gets around. This time, though, he is not kidnapped. He gets in a coffin and flies over there.
Yep. Oyarsa shows up, sends him.
Wow. Yep. That would be kind of tough for me to do.
I've kind of claustrophobic. You'd have to have so much trust.
What an amazing book. I have no idea again what I expected. I think in the last one we talked about Out of the Silent Planet, I mentioned surprise at that point too, and at that point I was like, yeah, this is like kind of like H.G. Wells, I don't know what I expected, but I didn't quite expect that stuff, you know, and all the philosophy in it. Well, this one totally blew me away. I had no idea whatever picture was in my head about what this book was, it wasn't even close. I had no idea, you know, we're talking about angels and demons and creation and the fall and, oh my goodness.
He dialed it up to 11 on this one. I'm like you, when I read all three of these books, I had no idea what any of them would be like. And I was so surprised each time I picked one up and read it. And this time through, I remembered, of course, the basics of the story, but there were so many things I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. So in this, it's funny because it starts off with C.S. Lewis himself as the Watson to Ransom's Holmes, essentially. He's his helper and narrator, or chronicler,
yeah.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
And he's on his way to Ransom's house, and he's filled with all these weird, vague fears. I could feel it going by old abandoned factories, down dark roads. Maybe Ransom's not the great guy he thought he was. And he gets there, and Ransom goes, oh, I wasn't sure you'd make it past the barrage. And he's like, what? He says, oh, they were trying to stop you. That's what that was.
Wow.
So yeah. From the beginning, evil is not happy with what's going to happen. And then he gets into this coffin and winds up going to Venus, Perelandra. And what they discover there is, what he discovers is essentially, it's not an exact parallel, but the parallel is that he meets Eve in paradise before it has fallen, in essentially the way ours did. And she's looking for Adam, essentially. She's the queen, the lady, and she's looking for the king. At first she thinks Ransom is the king. And so then this challenge of evil does show up, and Ransom's there to play a big part in it.
Yeah.
And so what you have is, it's a compelling story, I think, but it's also an in-depth look at innocence, temptation, how did God intend us to be, what lengths do you have to go to fight evil, how much commitment do you have to have in methods, and then what is God in the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which always brings me back to the question of, can a Christian, or can somebody who's not Christian, read this and appreciate it?
You know, that's a good question. I imagine the answer is yes, because I found it compelling, but I was, you know, saying, oh my gosh, you know, yeah, oh, look at that, look at that. There are a heck of a lot of philosophical conversations in it. So I think anybody who is interested in thinking about stuff, and, you know, just all stuff, it should be interested in the book, and it is extremely well written. And so I think that the answer is yes. I think it's fairly popular, isn't it?
It's still in print.
I don't know if it's popular among non-Christians.
Well, and the world building is not so great. Oh,
it is really amazing. Yeah.
If it was good in the first book, this book just takes that book and says, oh, really? Here's what else I can do.
Oh.
So original, so different.
Yeah, yeah.
I was stunned.
Yeah, and he's, you know, so when he meets this Eve character, they're on islands that float. They're like rafts, kind of. And, you know, he could see her, and then a wave would come, and he would be like, oh, now she's disappeared. You know, she's behind the wave, and now he's on top. And it's just, oh.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not doing it any justice at all, but the planet is just covered by these rafts. And when they kind of bump into each other, you can jump over or you can swim over to another one. And you can't see the sky at any time.
I know, that's weird. It's like they're inside of a golden globe because of the cloud cover, I guess, for Venus. Yeah. And it freaked me out a little bit when he was going to sleep and he's like, in the sky, there were no stars. The sky was absolutely dark. And I'm like, no. Mm-mm. He's like, he just went to sleep. And I was like, I find that supremely uncomfortable.
Yeah.
However, one of the things that's pointed out as we're slowly introduced to this world is that there's just so much general pleasure in it in terms of the colors are just right. The temperature is so comfortable. He says at one point, and the water, you can drink the water. It's slightly salty in the ocean, but it's so delicious and it's refreshing and all this. And anytime you eat anything, it has this effect on you that's not just that of food. It kind of enhances your senses and makes you appreciate things in a new way. And at one point, Ransom's going to try another one, and he says, just for the pleasure of it. And he's like, but I don't need it. That would be wrong here. There's this sense of, no, you just need that one. So yeah, everything is kind of complete in itself.
I love it. That's a carryover from that previous book, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this idea that, you know, one of humanity's failings is that we like something, and therefore more of it is better.
Yes.
And we want it all. We want more. But
I did recognize that personally. I just went, I get it. I know.
Yeah, me
exactly
too.
What's going on.
No question.
And so he even has this sense, it says he was really enjoying just being in the water. This is before he comes to the floating island and gets on it even. And it says, such tepid revelry in water, such glorious bathing, as one would have called it on Earth, suggested as its natural accompaniment a blazing sun. But here there was no such thing. The water gleamed, the sky burned with gold, but all was rich and dim, and his eyes fed upon it, undazzled and unaching. The very names of green and gold, which he used perforce in describing the scene, are too harsh for the tenderness, the muted iridescence of that warm, maternal, delicately gorgeous world. It was mild to look upon as evening, warm as summer, warm like summer noon, gentle and winning like early dawn. It was altogether pleasurable. He sighed. Just sounds great, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's just, yeah. Great. Yeah.
And all the animals are unique, original, and also kind of interestingly to me, they're all drawn to, not all of them. Some of them are very shy, but they're all drawn to people somehow.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah, it's pointed out several times.
Yeah,
that,
there was
you know,
a dragon-like creature that kind of liked to hang out with them.
So cute.
Yeah.
And toward the end, there's a creature that it almost sounded like a combination between a dog and an otter or something like that, but it's quite large, but it has this beautiful singing voice and it's singing with joy, but it's super shy, but it follows him. It's still interested, but it doesn't want to be looked at, you know? So
yeah,
this happens over and over again.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was sent there. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He was not, you know, he just didn't decide, oh, I think I'm going to go check out Venus.
Right. That's why Oyarsa came.
Yeah. So, you know, the C.S. Lewis character, I like that too, where, you know, so he shows up at Ransom's house and there's an Eldil there, mm-hmm. you know, the Oyarsa from Mars and, or whatever. And hey, we need you to head on over there. But they don't tell him why. He doesn't know why.
Right.
And, but he's compelled to do so and he does it. And, yeah, he gets into this coffin-like thing and flies over there. And he, I liked, you know, he tells Lewis, you know, hey, I have no idea how long I'm going to be gone. But yeah. I need you to check on the place and maybe I'll show up someday. You know, it was just great.
Yeah, your assignment is mm-hmm. to keep an eye on things so that if I come back, you can help me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't know what it's like or what shape I'll be in.
Right.
And that was interesting. And here, you can recruit this guy who's a doctor, or you can recruit from this small list of people who would believe me
yeah,
and believe you.
Yeah.
And so he gets a doctor on board to help.
Right. Yep.
So that's the beginning is all from Lewis's point of view. And so Ransom comes back and he's got all these red flowers all over him when they open it up. Mm-hmm. And then he tells his story. And then that's the most of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And his story is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, so he goes on this Venus. It is, you know, it's paradise and it's meant to be
mm-hmm.
Specifically. But then he does meet this woman. And, you know, everything that he's seen on the planet is a creature of some type. And, but it's just amazing. The whole thing's amazing. And he has no idea why he's there and he wonders. But then he meets this woman. And the woman's compelling. I like how she says, you know, I was young yesterday. So the first time she saw him, she started to laugh and is basically like pointing at him. And, you know, she's like showing all the other creatures, hey, look, what's over here? But she's just laughing with joy. And then I think if I remember right, Maladil, who is God,
mm-hmm.
right, sort of Jesus, let her know.
Isn't he?
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Or sort of let her know that, hey, he may not like that. So yeah. When they meet, you know, he says, well, I understand that laughing is... not something that you appreciate.
You laughing at you.
Yeah,
yes.
Laughing at you and pointing, right? So I apologize. I was young yesterday, but I'm older now and I understand.
And she says that all the time. She'll say, oh, I was very young, meaning I didn't know, but now I'm older. And he'll tell her something. She'll go, oh, now I'm older again. I know this. I have experience, essentially.
Right. And that was clearly something that she wanted to be, was older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's important that, you know, she took delight, you know, whenever, you know, there's sometimes he'd say something and she'd say, oh, I'm so much older now. This is awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So she appreciated that. She appreciated being told things, right?
Yeah. And she's laughing at him because the way he came, he wound up getting suntanned on one side through the coffin and not on the other. So she called him Piebald, which is what they call a pinto horse, that spotted uh-huh. horse.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
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 So she called him the Piebald because, you know, she doesn't know what he is.
Right.
And she's green.
Yeah, she's green. Yeah, but human-like.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
but definitely a woman.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, conversations and he's, I really liked how, you know, he comes there with Christianity in his head, right? He is Christian.
Yes, he is a
and
Christian.
He's got all this stuff in his head. And he slowly works out that, hey, you know, this is paradise here. And that may be even later. But, yeah, he slowly works that out.
Yeah, especially when she says she's looking for the king.
Yeah,
she thought she was kind of disappointed because she thought he was the king. And then, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and yeah, so they were together at one point, I guess. And then they got separated but she didn't seem upset about it in any way. You know, she's on some island on the planet somewhere. And
yeah,
eventually we'll bump into each other again. But yeah, she's looking for him. But she's not agitated by it at all.
No, because she's completely innocent, and not innocent. It's a really positive sort of innocence. It's innocence of trust and understanding, in a sense. So when they come to a, they do come to a place that's a big fixed island. It's called the Fixed Land, and which is what she calls it. And they're on their floating islands. And he wants to go see it. And she's like, oh, okay, you know. But she's like, well, and he says, well, we can just sleep here at some point. And she goes, oh, no. What? Oh, no, we have to get off. Because she's been forbidden. That's the one thing that she's been forbidden. You can't sleep on the Fixed Land. You can go visit it, but you can't. And that's when you go, oh, wait a minute. This doesn't seem to make any sense. Hold on. And so this is like Eve in our Garden of Eden with the apple. Doesn't seem to make any sense, but are you going to trust God and do what he wants? And she's perfectly, you know. And so he says, well, I've not been forbidden that. Well, how can that be? And he goes, oh, well, in my world, it was something else. And my lady gave into it. So it was, you know, my queen mother or whatever. And so that was a really bad thing. And she goes, oh, I don't, maybe he doesn't tell her that at that point. But he's like, she goes, oh, wait. Okay, so something can be forbidden to one, but not to the other world. Oh, all right. I'm older again.
Yeah, yeah. That's so, you know, cool.
Yeah, so very slowly, as he's exploring and meeting her and things are happening, we're having the philosophy also kind of unfolded for us. And then when it gets really intense is when the spaceship comes,
yeah,
and it's Weston who we met in the last book.
Right. Before we get to Weston, I was thinking, I really like, I'm on page 70. I don't know if you have a hard copy or not, but
yeah, I have a paperback.
Okay. So yeah, and that's
give it a try.
Okay. So, their conversations, you know, they're just so compelling between Ransom and,
the lady.
Yeah. So, if I'm just going to read this one little section. He says, that is one of the things that is bewildering me, said Ransom, that you are not different. You are shaped like the women of my own kind. I had not expected that. I have been in one other world beside my own, but the creatures there are not at all like you and me. And she says, what is bewildering about it? And he says, I do not see why different worlds should bring forth like creatures. Do different trees bring forth like fruit? But that other world was older than yours, she said. How do you know that? Asked Ransom in amazement. Maladil is telling me, answered the woman. And I love that. She's like in this constant, Jesus is constantly telling her things in her head, you know?
Yeah,
and, conversation. And I love that, yeah. And as she spoke, the landscape had become different, though with a difference none of the senses would identify. The light was dim, the air gentle, and all Ransom's body was bathed in bliss. But the garden world where he stood seemed to be packed quite full, and as if an unendurable pressure had been laid upon his shoulders, his legs failed him, and he half sank, half fell into a sitting position. It all comes into my mind now, she continued. I see the big furry creatures, the white giants, what is it you call them, the Sorns and the Blue Rivers? Oh, what a strong pleasure it would be to see them with my outward eyes, to touch them, and the stronger, because there are no more of that kind yet or to come. It is only in the ancient worlds they linger yet. Why? Said Ransom in a whisper, looking up at her. You must know that better than I, she said. For was it not in your own world that all this happened? All what? I thought it would be you who would tell me of it, said the woman, now in her turn bewildered. What are you talking about? Asked Ransom. I mean, said she, that in your world, Maladil first took himself in this form, the form of your race and mine. You know what, said Ransom sharply? Those who have had a dream which is very beautiful, but from which, nevertheless, they have ardently desired to awake, will understand his sensations. Yes, I know that. Or I said, you know that. I'm sorry, I misread. Yes, I know that. Maladil has made me older to that amount since we began speaking. The expression on her face was such as he had never seen and could not steadily look at. I think I'll just read the rest of the book from
here. No, keep going. I was going to tell you. Keep going.
Okay. The whole of this adventure seemed to be slipping out of his hands. There was a long silence. He stooped down to the water and drank before he spoke again. "Oh, my lady," he said, "why do you say that such creatures linger only in the ancient worlds?" "Are you so young?" she answered. "How could they come again? Since our beloved became a man, how should reason in any world take on another form? Do you not understand? That is all over. Among times there is a time that turns a corner, and everything this side of it is new. Times do not go backward." "And can one little world like mine be the corner?" "I do not understand. Corner with us is not the name of a size." "And do you," said Ransom with some hesitation, "and do you know why he came thus to my world?" All through this part of the conversation, he found it difficult to look higher than her feet, so that her answer was merely a voice in the air above him. "Yes," said the voice, "I know the reason, but it is not the reason you know. There was more than one reason, and there is one I know and cannot tell to you, and another that you know and cannot tell to me." "And after this," said Ransom, "it will all be men? You say this as if you were sorry." "I think," said Ransom, "I have no more understanding than a beast. I do not well know what I am saying, but I loved the furry people whom I met in Malacandra, that old world. Are they to be swept away? Are they only rubbish in deep heaven?" "I do not know what rubbish means," she answered, "nor what you are saying. You do not mean that they are worse because they come early in the history and do not come again? They are their own part of the history and not another. We are on this side of the wave and they on the far side. All is new."
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. But so true.
I had marked that also. Yeah. And it's that, in a sense, it made me realize that, you know, in the last book, one of Weston's problems that gets identified is he wants to hang on to everything just the way it is.
Mm.
We must always have people, so we must spread to the stars. And if something's in our way, we must get out of the way because it's more important than anything to keep the race going. And this idea that, you know, oh, but I loved those furry people, you know, and this idea of comparing them in a way that's not valid to the fact that if there's a new development, then the old development's not as good.
Yeah.
It's so common. It's still such a human failing, I think.
Yeah. And I can understand that. You know, I had a friend who passed away recently, and, you know, if you look at it in that respect, you know, there's a before and an after, you know, it's, I can't say, well, after is going to be better. You know, I can't possibly say that.
Right.
But yet he had his place, right? I mean, the life that he lived was his life, and now we're in a new part of life. But everything works that way, you know, not just people. It's, you know, the world, the whole cosmos, you know, which I think is a lot of what C.S. Lewis is getting after. Is this change in constant motion.
And that's kind of interesting because we're seeing that attitude, and we talked a little about this last time too, but we're seeing that attitude in the things that people want to hang on to now. So the idea that they used to call it global warming.
Mm.
Now they just say climate change because things might be cooling off. But it's like, this is bad and it's our fault.
Right.
And not that we might not affect things more than we should, and so we should fix that. I totally agree. But a lot of times it's out of our hands. If you look at the history of the Earth, but we want to keep it the way it is. And so if species are being affected by overheating or, you know, the way the climate's changing or whatever, because somehow we're attributing that to being our fault. And again, I'm not trying to deny that maybe we've sped the process up, but I remember listening to an In Our Time where they were talking about the history of global climate change as far back as they can go. And they can go pretty dang far back.
When
they look at it, millions of years, they talk about what we've done is accelerated it, but it's always happened. And everybody just had to get along with it. Species came and went. And so that's just one thing. You know, there's other things that people want to hang on to and keep the way they were without allowing change to happen. And this whole book, that's one of the key things is, you know, why is she supposed to live on the floating islands versus the fixed land? Well, by the end, I guess we're way into all this. Mm-hmm. By the end, she knows. It's so they can always be adaptable to change and not think everything should stay the same all the time.
Yeah, I mean, if I were to point it at something that I feel is unique in our time, mm-hmm. I would have to say the rate of change.
Yeah.
Whether that's true, whether we really are unique, I guess I can't be positive. But how fast things are changing now seems it's mind-boggling to me. And head spinning, right?
And I do, and I can't say I don't decry that. Mm-hmm. We suddenly turned one of those corners for good or ill, I think, relatively recently.
Yeah.
And so we've got a lot of social change on our hands and attitudes that from one side of the corner, they don't make sense. Or at least they seem extreme.
Right. Yeah.
And the way to deal with problems, and like we were talking before this, how Twitter, first Facebook and then Twitter, have changed even the way we communicate with each other and get along with each other socially in our country.
Yeah, yeah. And how we interact, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's
so something
amazing.
We always struggle with.
Have you noticed that, I don't know if you listen to any news podcasts.
Nope.
But they have started, and this was in about a year ago, maybe a year ago. Uh-huh. More than one of them have, we're recording this on April the 4th at 8:09 a.m. Things may have changed since then, And it's just like, really? Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just amazing.
I don't care for that.
Yeah, but that's
but on the other
hand, it's just like, hand, if you're hearing this at 9:09 a.m., this may not be accurate anymore. And it used to be that, you'd have a newspaper a day. Yeah, that's just something.
And if you were on the frontier, you got your news months later.
Yeah, for sure.
And if you were in ancient Rome.
Are we any better off? I don't know that we are.
Yeah.
look at things. I'm not sure that this is better. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, and is it better or is it worse? It's different.
Yeah, that's right.
And we haven't adjusted to it yet. We're at one of those corners. And so we keep looking back around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going, this was more comfortable. That might not have been better.
Right.
And it's those corners just seem to come faster, I think.
Yeah.
And I kind of took us with that conversation. I kind of took us away from what might be the thing that you wanted to focus on, which is that once Christ became man, that became the form of reason.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing that he's saying here is there are other worlds, right? But that, God incarnating into Jesus had universal effect. The before and after we feel on earth is a before and after in the cosmos.
Yeah, where she said, time, among times, there's a time that turns a corner and everything is new. Times don't go backward. And that's another theme, too, that's throughout this book is God does nothing the same way twice.
Hmm. Yeah.
There's always something different and new.
Yeah. And then it's this idea that, Mars was older than the Earth. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Earth. And remember from, for those of you who don't know, out of the Silent Planet, it was established that the Earth, we had the fallen nature, right? And the Eldil that was in charge of the Earth was Satan. And,
right.
But somehow that fall affected Mars, which is an interesting thing too. It's like a piece of it or something hit Mars. You remember? And it was like Mars was kind of dying.
No, it was the Oyar. Satan.
Okay.
The Earth's Eldil attacked Mars.
Attacked Mars. Okay.
And so that's what caused the fossilization and death at the top of Mars in the high altitudes.
Okay.
And then also that's what killed the moon.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah. And then now, but Venus has none of that. It
right.
seems to have touched Venus not one bit.
Right.
In fact, she's pretty much unaware of it until, she is informed of it. So.
Well, yeah, and because he says, do you know why he, meaning Jesus, came to my world? And she says, yes, but it's not the reason you know. There was more than one reason, and there's one I know and cannot tell to you, and another that you know and cannot tell to me.
Yeah, and why the can't they say? It's like, you know, why, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on this, but why can't she tell him and he tell her? It's that it's an understanding issue, not a secret thing. Is yes. What I got it. It's like, you know, I can't explain to you in your innocent state, your unfallen state, what happened sufficiently for you to understand what I think the reason is, right? Versa, right?
I agree. I think it goes so deep. It's something that's hard to put into words also.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the kind of thing like, a foreigner coming to this country.
Yeah.
And trying to explain a certain really American thing, not maybe hamburgers and hot dogs, that's easy, but some intrinsic belief that Americans have that goes so deep we haven't even really thought about it thoroughly, maybe.
Right, and trying to explain that to a person that doesn't share the basis of, you know, it's like we need to start way back, you know, and then there was creation, and then there was this, you know.
Yeah, it's almost like when I was telling you about watching a couple of different Indian movies where the end, the way vengeance and forgiveness was treated in the end, we went, whoa, suddenly the West's Christian heritage becomes really clear. Americans would not be comfortable with this. And we've seen it in more than one Indian movie. Well, they don't have that Christian context of forgiveness, how you treat vengeance, all this kind of thing. And so... Also, there were other aspects that we don't, but they're easier to understand. But it's that thing of going, how far back do you have to go to make these concepts clear that are so bone deep in us right now?
Right. Yeah. Yep.
So.
Yep. Just good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And let's talk some more about the fixed land. That was really interesting. So she was told, her and the king were told, you know, you can visit the fixed land, but don't sleep there. And it is something, like you said, that didn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
That's one of the difficult things about, you know, being a Christian. And I know I've said this lots of times before, but there, you know, everything you can, as you gain an understanding, as you move forward, sometimes it's pretty obvious. You're like, oh, this thing that you didn't understand before, now you do. And now you're like, ah, well, that's why that would be a bad thing to do. You know what I mean? But there are still, you know, things now and then that are like, well, I don't fully understand why I'm supposed to feel this way or not sleep on the fixed land, you know, basically. And, you know, but then you come to a point where you need to trust that and trust that you will understand.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, and I was just going to say she says that here, but go ahead.
Well, that's all I was going to say is he says, well, maybe my world's wrong about this, but, you know, you shouldn't. But just, no, he told me you guys don't have floating islands, so what else are you going to do, you know? And she says, but he is not telling me why he has forbidden it to us. There's probably some good reason, began Ransom, when he was interrupted by her sudden laughter. Oh, piebald, piebald, she said, still laughing. How often the people of your race speak. it's just that thing of, he says, and later on she goes, she's laughing because you just keep talking even when you don't have anything to say. And he goes, well, I actually had something to say. And... He's like, just because you don't think I don't have something to say, you know, doesn't mean that I didn't have a point to make, but she wasn't ready to hear it. But it was that idea of you don't have to have a good reason. Mm-hmm. Just do it. Why would you want to not do something that God ordered you to do? And that's the other part of her innocence is like, well, he said it, so it's right.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. I don't have to have my opinion.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah. And then right after that, he says, at least he added in a louder voice, this forbidding is no hardship in such a world as yours. Then she says, that is also a strange thing to say. Who thought of it as being hard? The beasts would not think it hard if I told them to walk on their heads. It would become their delight to walk on their heads. I am his beast, with a capital H.
Mm-hmm.
And all his biddings are joys. It is not that which makes me thoughtful, but it was coming into my mind to wonder whether there are two kinds of bidding. I thought that was really great. So I think that that's something that, you know, we come to realize as Christians is there's a point at which we realize that these directives, for want of a better word, that we live by are actually things that help us live lives that are worthwhile and actually help us be better. And I don't mean better from a good evil sense specifically, but I'm just saying that, you know, it's a truth. It's an undeniable truth that if you're a young person and then you wait until you're married to have children, and then you, you know, you do things kind of in this order that is mm-hmm. laid out, that your chances of succeeding in life are many, many times better than if you do not follow these rules that have become out of fashion. I mean, it's undeniable, you know, you can call it scientific proof, you know, but yet, we kind of don't want to. The thing I guess I'm saying is what, I agree with what she says in that, you know, you get to a point where when you realize that this is actually pointing you in the direction that you personally want to go and that, that's a joy, you know, you've got to have that realization.
Well, and for her, there's no such thing as personally wanting to go there. And so, isn't that great when it coincides with what God wants?
Yeah.
It's like, mm-hmm. oh, if that's what he wants, then that's what I want too.
Yeah.
That's my joy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, isn't that the state of the saints? And isn't that the state we are trying to get to?
Exactly.
Essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. So you said it way better than I did. But yeah, it's like, yeah, that's the state that we want to get to. Because,
right.
yeah, we can talk ourselves into that. But then again, that's an inner thing that you need to get to or you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. looked at by the secular world as, oh, yeah, you don't want to think for yourself. You don't want to be independent. You don't want it. And it's like, but all those things are available within that obeying and being his joy.
Mm-hmm.
It being our joy to do God's will. Because as you say, I mean, even the hardest jobs that we're given, it becomes your joy eventually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how else to explain it. And I have I only have a small understanding of it. I'm not like, you know, we've got the examples of saints and martyrs who did incredibly difficult things that brought great good to others, but they themselves had a tough row to hoe. But if they're that much in accordance with God's will, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm good with it.
Yeah.
And that's why it's hard for us to imagine it. Because we can, and in fact, at some point later, she's talking about, oh, I get it. You've got this way of thinking where you think about what if this happened instead of that, and you dwell on the thing that didn't happen, that you wanted to have happen instead. She says, so this is the reason, I think that's when she's saying, this is the reason I ran into you. I ran into you instead of the king. So I didn't run into him yet. I thought it was you, but I'm not going to worry about it. This is good too. And he's like, and I can't remember if he says something like, oh, I'm super sorry about this or that, or, but she relates whatever when she realizes this way of thinking back. And she says, well, but if I'd have run into him, I wouldn't run into you. I would have given up one good for another. What is the point of dwelling on that? Here I am.
Yeah,
this is good too.
Yeah. And he takes it even farther in this book where they're talking about the fall on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, in one of those prayers at the end, you know, where they say, blessed is he, mm-hmm. it says they called it fortunate, the fortunate sin. Right.
That's, is that Thomas Aquinas, I think?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of, you know, in a big picture way says the same thing that you're saying. you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, amazing.
I mean, it would have been better if that had never happened, but here we are.
Yeah, and the reason, yeah, he says that in this book too, and I don't know that I have it marked, but maybe you do, but
it says
something like, it is not as good as the plan he had for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you hadn't done that, the plan he had for you was better, but he took what happened and did what good could be done from it, right?
Yeah.
So that just blows me away. You know, it's something that, you know, you knew, but you know, you can get to contemplate it in this different way.
Yeah. So. It's yeah. And it's so the kind of that lesson of it is don't cling to what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
You have to live with what is here and what is the good that is here. Wow. Let's embrace that and go on, because you can't turn that corner.
You just reminded me of something from Tolkien, right? Remember Gandalf talking to Frodo about living the times that you're in.
Right.
Yeah.
I wish I had not lived to see such times. Yeah. So do all.
Right.
Or maybe he says, so do all who live to see such times. But all we can do is decide what choices we're going to make right now, what we're going to do with the time we're given.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And I heard that these two met once or twice.
May have even read these books to each other out loud as they were being written.
It's like, you know, I can feel Tolkien in here when he does things like the word Eldil and Maladil. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just, in my head, they were talking to each other and they worked that out together. And I have no proof of that, but it just makes me happy. So.
Well, he made him a linguist, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, Lewis made Ransom a linguist. Well, that's his friend, there's a better word for it than that. But, you know, that's Tolkien. That was what he did, a philologist. That was what he did. That's why he made up all those languages, you know, to keep his mind off World War I when he was in it, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there are echoes back and forth to each other. Definitely, I agree.
Love it.
And then they, you know, then unfortunately, but I think it had to happen because you can't keep evil away. Mm-hmm. Weston lands.
Yeah, here comes Weston. And that, you know, the biggest surprise for me of this book is Weston. You know, so Weston, the part about it that surprised me is that he was possessed or... I would say he was possessed of a demon, right? He didn't turn into a demon.
No.
He was actually gone at some point where he wasn't even present. And man, that stuff really spooked me out.
It was creepy.
It was very creepy, and you know, it just felt it really surprised me. Yeah.
No, I agree. And made creepier by the fact that you only gradually realize it, of course, as he shows his hand.
Yeah.
In his arguments with the lady, as he's trying to kind of gradually mold her mind into a different way of thinking so that she'll disobey God.
Right. And again, like in Out of the Silent Planet, he's making this story that's in the Bible. He's showing you how it might have happened, you know, and really putting people into it, you know, personalities into it, and it just really makes it sink in, you know, what occurred.
Because I have to say, I read the story of Genesis, or you know, the second creation story, and here comes the devil and they eat the piece of fruit, and it's like, thanks for nothing, you guys. Which is easy for me to say, who can't go a day without kind of going, oh, that does seem like a better idea for me. I'll just do that instead.
Yeah,
but, you know, I'm like, really? You walked with God every night. He was your best friend. Why did you not call out for help? But what you see is in this book, I gain a great amount of sympathy because in her innocence, I keep wanting to call her Eve, but the lady is having quite reasonable conversations with Weston, the devil, and with Ransom, as she tries to work things out and understand. And he just keeps shifting his angle a little and a little. And as Ransom says, most of what he's saying is true. He's just twisting it some.
Yeah.
So that he's gradually building up this idea of her as the savior of mankind and the children by telling her story after story after story of Earth-style heroines and the things that they had to battle against.
Yeah.
And as he gradually conditions her mind through story, she kind of starts to kind of take on a bit of a different air. She's thinking about herself differently. You know?
Yeah, and he's taking advantage of her joy at being older, right? And you know, I could feel that, you know, when she says, oh, I'm so much older now, you know, I'm learning so much. And Ransom watching that happen. And I was just like, oh, no, what's going to happen here? But yeah, then that's when Ransom realizes this is my purpose. This is the reason I am here. Is to, well, he actually says in here, so that is why I have been sent here. He failed on Malakandra, and now he is coming here, he being Weston.
Yeah.
And it is up to me to do something about it. A terrible sense of inadequacy swept over him. So, but yeah, so that's why he's been sent. And then he does admirably, in my opinion. So it starts with him talking, right? He says, no, 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 wait a minute, wait a minute. I'm going to tell you what it really is, you know? And then he laments how he has to sleep more than the other two. When he found out that Weston actually didn't sleep.
Yeah.
Because he's possessed of a demon.
Yeah.
And the lady doesn't have to sleep as much as him. And he's doing his best. So he'd wake up and they'd be in mid-conversation.
Yeah.
And so that was just really something.
Yeah, and that was the thing to me, to watch the sorts of things that she was being tempted essentially to put herself into, the mindset of being important.
Yeah.
You know, she hadn't thought about that before. And she wasn't really fully embracing it. But there was a point where he's like, oh, my gosh, she got this look on her, kind of a familiar look on her face. And he's going, oh, wait, I know this from dramas. She's the doomed heroine. He's like, oh, crap, it's starting to work. Well, and also, because this isn't just a demon. This is Satan.
Yeah, right.
When he quotes Christ on the cross at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he says, it's not like he was quoting it. It was like he was remembering it. And you're just like, ugh.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So this makes the whole thing just seem more personal.
Yeah.
More vivid.
Mm-hmm.
By saying it like that. But he also brings death and murder. I mean, a death. He's killing the little animals for no reason other than to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
These joyful little hopping frog type things. He makes her a dress out of feathers. And the first thing Ransom says is, oh, the poor birds. And she's like, oh, he told me they dropped their feathers somewhere. You know,
yeah.
She doesn't know.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, aren't you, yeah. Look at yourself in this mirror. Aren't you more pretty wearing these feathers? You know, so I think that he does basically three main things, you know, tempts her three times. And then Ransom realizes that this is going to go on forever.
A thought pops into his head, this has got to stop.
Right. And then that's
not his thought.
Right, right. And then I think you mentioned during the introduction to the podcast, you said something about, you know, how far do you need to go to fight evil?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the question that Ransom is faced with.
Which is all the way.
Yeah. So he's like, you know, this is going to get physical now. And it scares him to death. But there is a trust of, well, this has got to work out. I think this is going to work out. And, also, Weston is not there. You know, this is Satan that he's fighting. It's not...
Yeah,
Weston.
It's because at one point when he's been fairly sure, but he's trying to reason with him, and he says, And then idiot, said Weston. His voice was almost a howl, and he had risen to his feet. Idiot, he repeated, can you understand nothing? Will you always try to press everything back into the miserable framework of your old jargon about self and self-sacrifice? That is the old accursed dualism in another form. There is no possible distinction in concrete thought between me and the universe. Insofar as I am the conductor of the central forward pressure of the universe, I am it. Do you see, you timid, scruple-mongering fool? I am the universe. I, Weston, am your God and your devil. I call that force into me completely. Then horrible things began happening. A spasm like that preceding a deadly vomit twisted Weston's face out of recognition. As it passed, for 1 second, something like the old Weston reappeared. The old Weston, staring with eyes of horror and howling, Ransom! Ransom! For Christ's sake, don't let them! And instantly his whole body spun round as if he had been hit by a revolver bullet, and he fell to the earth and was there rolling at Ransom's feet, slavering and chattering and tearing up the moss by handfuls.
Wow.
So that's where he might be in there. But, yeah, he's not running that show.
Yep.
And it's funny because that's where Lewis lets us know, and Ransom, okay, you're dealing with something big. You suspected it, but now you know. And then it's interesting because later on, the devil, just call it that, uses letting Ransom up or Weston up his consciousness out a little bit every so often to keep Ransom feeling pity for him.
Mm.
Well, gosh, maybe he's in there. Maybe I can, you know, can I save him? He doesn't really wonder that a lot because he's got a bigger job to do.
Yeah.
But it is interesting.
But yeah, you know, Satan's a liar. So it's like, you know, is Weston really there? Or is that acting?
Yeah.
You know?
And that's what he's wondering. He's like, I don't know. And I can't save him.
Yeah.
You know? But it's, and what was interesting to me also is, so Ransom's struggle, his temptation, he realizes, I probably have to use physical violence. And, you know, he's having thoughts come into his head that's like, then the thought occurred to him. And what becomes clearer as that passage goes on is that's actually more of a conversation he's having, both with his own conscience and with Maladil. And so his first struggle is he's arguing about, oh, well, no, we should just be able to have conversation. We don't need to get physical about this. And then he's struggling because he's trying to protect the lady. How do I protect her while all this is going on? And I'm sorry, I was taking that back too far. But then his struggle is, I can't do this. This isn't right. And the voice says, my name also is Ransom.
Mm-hmm.
And it stops him in his tracks because he'd always thought as a philologist going, oh, my name actually means son of so-and-so. I didn't think about the word it has become.
Yeah.
I am the Ransom. And that gives him a whole new perspective. And it's funny because he's just like any normal person would be. He doesn't go, oh, now I'm filled with the strength of 10. I'm going to go off and do this thing for my God. He's like, oh, well, but I'm pretty weak and I don't think I can do anything. And I remember he had really long fingernails. And that's going to hurt so much.
Yeah.
And eventually, though, the arguments die down and he's like, okay, I'm all in. I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And he does it. And it takes a while.
And it made me think again, you had been talking with the first book about the times he was writing this in. So this was around World War I, right?
Yeah. So this one was 1943 is when it was published. So right in World War II.
Yeah, World War II. Mm-hmm. And you have all these arguments during the war even going on about should we be fighting this war? What does it take to, you know, what is our commitment? How much should we be involved? And it's like, could you get a more clear sign of evil than these concentration camps and the countries being overrun and the way things are happening? And eventually it comes down, you have to fight. You have to stop it any way you can. And that's what he's talking about in this book, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And quite a battle it is. You know, it takes a long time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, the most striking part of that, in my opinion, is where, you know, it's like he thinks he's won, but the demon reasserts, comes back to life, you know, his body, and then tries to drown Ransom.
Yeah.
And they go down and down and down, and suddenly he's awake in a, like on a shoreline, and, you know, they fight some more, and, you know, you realize, or he realizes that he's in a cavern.
Yeah, because the light's never coming back. He's sitting on the body.
Yeah.
Trying to keep himself awake because he's like, I can't trust this thing not to come back alive again.
Yeah. Just amazing.
It's like a nightmare. In total darkness. And I'm like, again, with my own personal problems where I'm like, this is the worst.
Wow.
So he thinks he's really killed him.
Mm-hmm.
For all we know, he has. And he's having to feel his way around. No, I can't go down there. No, I can't go up here. And he finally finds a place where maybe he could climb. And then he's like, how do I even get out of this place I've gotten myself into? And then behind him comes the sound of climbing.
Hmm.
And he's calling him by now. He's not calling him Weston. He's calling him the Unman.
Yeah.
Which I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did too.
And he's like, but he's got a broken leg. And he's like, no, there he comes. And some horrible monster shadow behind him, at one point he thinks, they're trying to scare me. And that made me think of when Lewis was on the way to Ransom's house in the beginning. And it's like,
right.
It's really similar. It's you have to fight through those feelings because those feelings aren't actually real, but they will be used however they can in the presence of evil to stop you. Because then he has to take his head off, which is like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah. You
know, like cutting off the head of the snake, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. And, oh, good connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hurls a stone at his head.
His heel that never.
He ends up with that wound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he sees that the creature that was casting this scary shadow is just like a giant beetle.
Mm.
It's looking at him going, huh, I was attracted. He was attracted because he was attracted to humans.
Mm.
Like all animals are. And he's like, well, but there's nothing here. So I'm going to go back to where I was before. Perfectly harmless.
Yeah.
And so it's just for the heel thing, just since we mentioned it. So at some point later, I think, maybe then, he realizes sometime during the fight, his heel was bitten or damaged or something, but it keeps bleeding.
Yeah, it was bitten because he said, you know, it was human teeth that bit him.
Oh, that was it that tore it up. Oh, my gosh. So... yeah, and that never heals. It doesn't matter what anyone does to it through to the end of the book.
Yeah,
and
even when he gets back to Earth, it's still
right. Bleeding. It keeps going.
Yeah,
and we'll see it. It just spoiler in the next book. It's the same way.
Ah, okay.
And so that harkens the deliberate callback to Genesis, where God tells the serpent, or you know, the devil, basically, I'm going to put enmity between you. And the man or the seed, the woman and the seed, her seed will crush you with his heel. He'll crawl on your belly. I don't have the direct quote. So I've mangled
it. Way to go, C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
Making that connection.
In case we didn't get it.
That's
we
so
did.
Good.
We got
That's
it.
So good. So what he did there and all of that is he prevented the fall.
Yeah.
On Venus.
Right.
Yeah. Everything turned out A-okay. So they're back to paradise.
Yeah, because he shows up at one point and says, later at the end, when he's met the king and the lady again, and she says, oh, yeah, you took him away. And I woke up and my mind was correct. I mean, you know, all those bad thoughts were gone. Because Maladil had said, I'm going to put her to sleep and make sure she stays asleep. You have to deal with this.
Mm.
And so it's interesting that human sacrifice that has to be made of some sort of fighting evil. And so in a sense, you kind of wonder if this is Lewis's commentary on the Garden of Eden, which of course it is. If Adam had spoken up when Eve was being tempted, it might have been a fight. It might have been just saying no. Who knows what it would have taken. but there was no one to help her.
Right. Yeah.
That's who would have done it on our world.
That is interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's not as clear cut as, you know, it was just Eve who did it and then dragged Adam along with her. You know, there had to have been more to it than that.
Well, I know I've read that people like Scott Hahn and other people have said, when you look at the way the text is written, when the serpent is talking, it is using the plural form of the word you for things like you could eat the fruit.
Gotcha. Okay. You
know, so it's the implication is that Adam could be there. I mean, I guess he could be saying you could eat it and Adam's not there. But the implication is that Adam's there. He's just not saying anything. Not calling God for help. He's not doing anything, which is, you know, of course, the worst reading of the whole thing. But this looks like Lewis's commentary on that, too. Toward the end, he's getting into these deeper philosophical just musings.
Yeah.
That he's tying to the angels and the planets. Because what was interesting to me, really, was the fact of the way that the angels, which is what the Oyarsa are, really, were trying to put themselves into a form, because they're like, the king and the queen are coming. We need to be more than a couple of bits of light. We need to be something that they can see. And it was right before this, I guess, because that's why he was saying they didn't have any sexual characteristics, but you could tell they were one thing or the other. And so they're saying, would you have the king strain his eyes to see those who come to do him honor, said the Archon of Paralandra. But look on this and tell us how it deals with you. The very faint light, the almost imperceptible alteration in the visual field which betokens an ill deal, vanished suddenly. The rosy peaks and the calm pool vanished also. A tornado of sheer monstrosity seemed to be pouring over Ransom, darting pillars filled with eyes, lighting pulsations of flame, talons and beaks, and billowy masses of what suggested snow, volleyed through cubes and heptagons into an infinite black void. Stop it! Stop it! He yelled, and the scene cleared. He was able to go, no, this is not going to work. So, all right, let's try this. And he looked with some reluctance, and far off between the peaks on the other side of the little valley came rolling wheels. There was nothing but that, concentric wheels moving with a rather sickening slowness, one inside the other. There was nothing terrible about them if you could get used to their appalling size, but there was nothing also significant. And he told them to try another time. And so then he said, two human figures appeared, and they were 30 feet tall. They were burning white like white hot iron. The outline of their bodies kind of undulated a little, like they were kind of moving, like with the matter that was inside of them. And he says, for a fraction of an inch inward from this outline, the landscape was just visible through them. Beyond that, they were opaque. Whenever he looked straight at them, they appeared to be rushing toward him with enormous speed. Whenever his eyes took in their surroundings, he realized that they were stationary. This may have been due in part to the fact that their long and sparkling hair stood out straight behind them as if in a great wind. But if there were a wind, it was not made of air, for no petal of the flowers were shaken. He remembered the words of the Oyarsa long ago in Mars. I am not here in the same way you are here. It was borne in upon him that the creatures were really moving, though not moving in relation to him. This planet, which inevitably seemed to him while he was in it, an unmoving world, the world, in fact, was to them a thing moving through the heavens. In relation to their own celestial frame of reference, they were rushing forward to keep abreast of the mountain valley. Had they stood still, they would have flashed past him too quickly for him to see. Doubly dropped behind the planet's spin on its own axis and by its own onward march to the sun. So it's this thing he's using all these different images that the prophets have used.
Mm.
So the wheels within wheels and the some of that first vision also are from Ezekiel. You know, you read the beginning of Ezekiel where he's like, this is what appeared to me. And you sit and you really try to imagine it. Your mind will break. I mean, you can imagine it, but we can't imagine it the way they would have thought of it, which would have been incomprehensible because it seems to kind of feed into our ideas of machined things and electronics and glass. And they didn't have any of that back then.
Right.
So I thought Lewis did a really great job of kind of trying to translate all these ways of looking at things that cannot possibly be described and understood in the same way that we understand everything else around us.
Wow. That is cool. And it just, you know, there's like Dante in there. It just feels Dante-ish. You know, he's in there too.
Especially when they talk about the great dance.
Wow, what an awesome scene that was. You know, I love how he talked about, you know, like the Eldil. When the Eldil talk to you, it's not as if they're speaking out loud. It's almost like they're putting their words in your head. You know, so it's like, you know, they all sound the same because they're interacting with you differently than a human being would. I loved that. And then there was this, where they all said, you know, blessed is he, all these things.
Yeah.
Just awesome. And it says right in the beginning, right that, you know, these could have all been said at the same moment. You know, it's just really just. Yeah, I can't say enough about that. It was just really great.
Yeah, I have to say that whole thing of the beginning of the great dance, said Tor, which is the king's name. I know little of it as yet. Let the Eldila speak. And then this goes on for, at least in my book, 5 or 6 pages.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, but it's amazing.
It really it is.
It's worth sticking with it. If you kind of, I had to stop partway through and go, okay, I must collect my thoughts. I'll come back to this later, because it's kind of, it's overwhelming. But there's a section where he says, he's talking about, you know, the history. Somehow he knew these particles were the secular generalities of what history tells. People, institutions, climates of opinion, civilizations, arts, sciences, and the like. Ephemeral coruscations that piped their short song and vanished. The ribbons or cords themselves, in which millions of corpuscles lived and died, were things of some different kind. At first, he could not say what. But he knew in the end that most of them were individual entities. If so, the time in which the great dance proceeds is very unlike time as we know it. Some of the thinner and more delicate cords were beings that we call short-lived, flowers and insects, a fruit or a storm of rain, and once, he thought, a wave of the sea. Others were such things as we also think lasting, crystals, rivers, mountains, or even stars. Far above these in girth and luminosity and flashing with colors beyond our spectrum were the lines of personal beings, yet as different from one another in splendor as all of them from the previous class. But not all the cords were individuals. Some were universal truths or universal qualities. It did not surprise him then to find that these and the persons were both cords, and both stood together as against the mere atoms of generality which lived and died in the dashing of their streams. And it just keeps going. I mean, it's insanely wonderful. And maybe I picked the worst part to read to you. I can't tell.
Oh, it's great.
But I was just, I was struck by that because it was really binding together everything. All matter.
Wow. Yeah.
And, cause he, you know, it just talks about, it's just amazing.
It really is. I mean, when he starts to talk that way about the cosmos and, all these things in this great dance, you know, these beings and life, and it's just stunning. Yeah. Just beautiful. Super amazing.
Yeah.
I wish I had better words, but it just blew me away. I'm just like, my goodness. You know, again, that was another surprise in this book. I just, you know, I've read some Narnia books in the past. This is nothing like those.
Oh, no.
Yeah. You read this book and man, it's just, there's so much in here. So much. And it's just so deep. Really great.
Yeah, it really is great. And I also really particularly loved once the king and the lady are there and all the animals are there, because they're all coming, at least a pair of each, and to the top of this mountain. And he says, that, so on one side you have the voice and the Snow White face of the Eldil and everything, and there it's contrasting with the men. So on the other, the blood coursing in the veins, the feeling trembling on the lips and sparkling in the eyes, the might of the man's shoulders, the wonder of the woman's breasts, a splendor of virility and richness of womanhood unknown on earth, a living torrent of perfect animality. But yet when these met, the one did not seem rank or the other spectral, animal rationale, an animal, yet also a reasonable soul. Such, he remembered, was the old definition of man, but he had never till now seen the reality. For now he saw this living paradise, the Lord and Lady, as the resolution of discords, the bridge that spans what would else be a chasm in creation, the keystone of the whole arch. By entering that mountain valley, they had suddenly united the warm multitude of the brutes behind him with the transcorporeal intelligences at his side. They closed the circle, and with their coming, all the separate notes of strength or beauty which that assembly had hitherto struck became one music.
Hmm. Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, we too often like to break it down and go, well, why were lions made with those teeth if they weren't going to eat something like, you know, that's not the point, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The point is a bigger picture. It's all of creation. Like that.
Wow. Stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Way to go, Mr. Lewis.
I know, right?
He's going to sell a lot of these.
Let's hope they go on, but they're not a flash in the pan, right?
Yep. So, wow. So the next one is, what is it called again? Oh, there it is. That Hideous Strength.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And you said that takes place on the Earth.
Yes.
Okay.
We're back on Earth for that one.
All right. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's funny to me how different all three of these are.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's cool.
And the Narnia Chronicles are good for the audience they were written for, but if you didn't grow up with them, they're not at all on this level.
Yeah.
You know, this is for grown-ups.
You know, what's funny is some libraries put this in the YA section. There's nothing in it that's not appropriate for youth, mm-hmm. but it's definitely, you know, it's a thinking book.
Yeah, I think you would lose a lot of them, frankly, because you have to already be interested in this sort of thing for it to really strike you the right way. I could see why people might not like it.
Mm, yeah.
Because of all the talking and everything.
Right, right.
But
I'm glad
you liked it.
I loved it. I thought it was awesome. Yes, yeah. in the correct sense of that word. I just loved it.
Yeah. It really is an amazing accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how he got all that into one book.
Yeah.
You know, and it really is the best kind of, this is really fantasy, not science fiction, I would say, but it really is the best kind of, how do you explore a concept thoroughly? Well, you put it into a completely different setting and take a look at what shakes out when it's there. And you and I before were talking about another author who does that same thing in modern style particularly well, and that's Ted
Chiang. Ted Chiang, right. Yeah, exploring philosophical idea and then, seeing what shakes out.
And honestly, mm-hmm. he does it honestly. He doesn't start off, as far as I've ever read, he doesn't start off going, here's what I want to prove to everyone. He starts off saying, what if?
Right, right.
What would the Tower of Babel have been?
Yeah.
What would that have meant to everybody? What would it have been like? You know?
Yeah.
Just, yeah. Yep. And then he follows it where it goes.
That's right.
For good or bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, he's just, I think that's something that's, you know, he's unique in today's writers, I think. You know, there are other writers that do some idea exploration. But I think most of what's being written right now is not really idea exploration. It's trying to mimic things like Game of Thrones, you know, or Joss Whedon, you know, snarky characters and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, or they're trying to prove a point.
Yeah, there is a lot of that too. The kind of a progressive point making. Yes. Yep. There is a lot of that.
Conservatives will do it too.
Yeah. No question. No question. But I think the prevalent stuff that's being written right now is really progressive.
Right. Yeah.
In the science fiction world, anyway. Well, you know what the award winners and things are. You know, there are definitely conservative science fiction writers out there, and.
Well, and in that case, it's like the Oscars, because, you know, you look at the movies that are nominated, maybe a broad range of movies, but you look at what's going to win and you're like, it's going to be one of these three movies.
Yeah,
these have these topics in them.
Yeah, I think that they've made a, you know, they need to see it as they're losing relevance if you can pick the winner without ever having seen any of the films.
Yeah.
You know, and I had a friend who actually picked that one.
Oh, okay.
And he was just using logic. He hadn't seen him. He was like, well, this one probably won't win because it's in a foreign language.
Oh,
you know, this one can't win because of this. And, you know, but yeah, the, you know, the identity stuff was a large part of it. So.
Yeah, but and so we're talking about Green Book, and that's, I've not seen it yet, but I will pretty soon, because every place I do movie discussions loved it.
Mm.
So May is my Green Book month.
Cool.
But, and I like Viggo Mortensen and all that. It's probably fine.
Sure.
I may love it. I don't know. But, but you look at the range of movies, and I was like, I wanted Black Panther to win. I'm like, it was making some good points. But it entertained the heck out of me while it was doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe Green Book does too, for all I know. But I looked at that and went, they're never going to let it win. It's too popular.
Mm.
So, because that's also kind of a snobbery.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, if it makes too much money. And that's why they wanted to add the blockbuster award, essentially.
Yeah, I think that's a big mistake. They shouldn't.
Well, they're not going to.
Yeah, that's what I heard. But that wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
How are you going to define that and all that stuff?
It's
a different class of movie. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of taken us far away from what we're talking about with this book, except for the fact that Lewis didn't write this to be popular.
Yeah.
I mean, he wrote it to write a story he was interested in reading himself.
Yeah.
And if more people did that, you know, I think they'd find it, you know, like with Tolkien and The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and various other books, or even, you know, Dickens. He was totally making a point. There was never any doubt about whose side he was on, but he was entertaining you so much at the same time and showing both sides of everything a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. He's going to be popular too.
I've got my fingers crossed. I'm doing my best. You know, we keep reading him here.
I love it. I love it.
So anyway.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, thank you for these two. I'm looking forward to the third.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, can't wait. But not next, though. The next, we're going to talk about a movie called PK.
Yes.
I love it.
It was a blockbuster.
It was?
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yes, it was hugely popular, and it is funny and light, and it's Indian. Uh-huh. What a shock. But it talks about religion in a very interesting way.
Oh,
so,
cool.
Yeah. Right. That's when you think about it, where is a land that has more varied religions that are right out there in everybody's face than India?
Hmm.
So, it's a quite a funny movie. It's an alien who comes to Earth and has to learn all about us. And he loses his remote control, which will get his ship back. And then he discovers this thing called God. And if you ask him hard enough, evidently, he'll give you your wish. So, can I please have my remote back? And that's kind of what drives the movie.
Oh, interesting.
Is what he discovers on the way while he's on this journey.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm looking forward to that too. So fun.
Yeah. I think one thing we'll all agree, and I'll probably say this again because it's hilarious, is that the aliens from that planet are ripped. They take their shirts off and their clothes as much as possible. Yeah.
That's funny. Oh, so we got that to look forward to.
Yep.
All right.
Enjoy, everybody. I'm just thinking of you.
That's great.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes, thanks. Have
see
a great
you
couple of weeks.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.